Please help me welcome our speaker tonight, Dean M. from the Alcoholics in Action group up in Augusta, Maine.
Oh, is this going to be like this all meeting? It's just this light here. All right, well, I can deal with that. No, that's fine. My name's Dean, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'd like to thank Jeff, actually, who I worked this out with a couple of months ago. First, I'd like to thank him and members of this group for coming up and supporting groups up in the Maine area. There's kind of some pockets of enthusiasm up there, like what I'm seeing here, and the speakers coming up. You know, I'm from an area where if the meeting across the street's terrible, but there's one 5 minutes up the road, you just go to the one that's terrible, because who wants to spend 5 minutes to go to the other one? You know, it's just like, and when I started, like, hearing that people were actually coming from different towns and then a whole other state, I was like, oh, my God, you know. And then it just got to the point where, you know, I'm not sure what I know something's really cool about that, many things, but I'm not really sure exactly what. It doesn't matter. I just think it's, I don't know, it's kind of like, when you're fishing and you're in a spot and you're like, this spot's terrible, I'm going to go over there. And it's not really any better over there, but you think it is because it's over there. And maybe that's what the speaker thinks about. I don't know. But, you know, one thing I do know is that since I started in this, some of the traditions that I work with today in the program, I met a lot of speakers who are very similar in the message that they carry from the podium and very similar in why they speak from the podium. And I'm just very enthusiastic to be part of it, because my sobriety date is December 17th, 1984. And my like sobriety date mentally is about 2 years ago up until now. So, you know, don't let all that time, it means very little to me. It really does. I'm definitely by definition a real alcoholic. I read that. I've had the opportunity to go back and reread the Big Book. You know, now that I'm not reading it to argue with people, I read it to save my own life, and then I started reading it to help people. And I fit that definition. And to just go back to share one of the things I've learned over the last couple of years listening to speakers, because for the first 24 years of my sobriety, I talked at every, and then nothing against discussion meetings or talking at discussion meetings, but I've abused my privileges there. It's really better if I don't even go. You know, I talk at discussion meetings from December 17th, 1984, right up until I started working with my current sponsors and doing this whole, I mean, I just couldn't stop. I just went there and I just gave my opinion. Sometimes my opinion had something to do with the steps. Most of the time it didn't, you know. Usually a bunch of people told me, oh, that was cool, you know, I'm glad you told that guy off, and somebody needed to say this, and I thought that was always my job, to either teach people something or to confront somebody, or, you know, I had no idea about sharing any spiritual message. You're trying to stand up here and help people just kind of stay focused on the spiritual path. I thought it was about me. I mean, talking at meetings is about me. And, you know, I'd never go to a speaker's meeting except for one exception. And you're looking at it. If I was speaking, I'd be there. If I wasn't speaking, I wouldn't be there. And you know, it got to the point where I literally couldn't stand myself. And I couldn't stand listening to myself anymore. It was just, and I couldn't stop talking at these meetings. And it was, so, you know, I can remember that, well, I'm still going to back up because I don't want to miss anything. But, you know, when I was born into an alcoholic family, and I, you know, nobody announced it. Hey, geez, we're alcoholics. I hope you get used to it. You know, it was just, you know, I don't think I know my father didn't want to be an alcoholic. He's in this program, and we've talked about it. He didn't. That wasn't his intent any more than it was mine. In my particular family, everybody drank. Nobody hid it. Like some people have these nice stories about how, well, you know, geez, after supper things would get a little crazy. I mean, supper would go through the window at my house if it was being prepared. Depended on if it would be on the table, would the cops show up, who knows, you know, just whatever. And it was pretty rough. And you know, for a long time in this program, that was like a whole bunch of what I couldn't get past. I just couldn't get past my unique childhood, you know, how brutal that was. And I couldn't get past just tons of different things that made me different from you. You know, I didn't know that the one thing that made me different from you was really my alcoholic ego. We all have it, but it makes us all completely different. We can't identify, and I certainly couldn't I couldn't identify with anybody. So if you'd listen to me for a few minutes, maybe I could identify with you after I was done talking. But I couldn't identify with you up front. You know, I had to get something out of it. So, and so, you know, I grew up in an alcoholic household. There was a lot of violence. My parents, you know, was very physical. I wasn't physically abused, but it was just everything else that you could imagine growing up in an alcoholic household. My mother and father certainly physically abused each other quite a bit. So, and it was kind of even, you know, it wasn't like, my mother really pounded my father on several occasions. So I never really knew who to root for. It was a pretty brutal one. I've heard a lot of people talk from the podium about what their experience was growing up, and some of us grew up in a pretty normal, you know, kind of environment with nothing really strange was going on. We just were full of this fear. For me, I grew up in a really strange environment, but I wasn't full of this fear for a long time. For the first like 5 or 6 years of my life, I can remember, I'm the oldest of 3 kids, and I can remember watching my parents going, something is wrong with these 2 people. I mean, I was like 5 thinking, what is wrong with you 2? Once you grow up, you know, it was like I was 5 years old thinking, I was really kind of sensitive and, so I had that going for me. I definitely was sensitive and kind of scared of everything, but not like an alcoholic. You know, that kind of changed when I was around 8, and I don't know why. You know, we moved at that time. That was pretty traumatic for me. Nobody else noticed it because they were all doing their own thing. But I can remember just feeling like from the time we moved from I'm from Maine, so when I say rural setting, I mean a rural setting in Maine means no one else lives in that whole area. You know, you're like by yourself. So we moved from a rural area to a town, which around here is like a rural area, I would guess. And moving to that town was literally for me like moving to New York City. I mean, there was like a couple hundred kids in this elementary school. I was just, you know, I didn't know what to make of it. And I can remember staying back in the 3rd grade, and it just sounds stupid now, but I just felt like from that moment on, I just felt dumb, first of all, like there's something wrong with me, I couldn't. Most people, they stay back, yay, you know, break time and big deal. And I was small for my age. All my parents were fighting. We'd moved from, you know, and I didn't make new friends. I just got started fighting a lot, and it was just a mess. Some sort of normalcy entered my life at that point. Would I be standing up here? I don't know. I really don't care. I do know that around that time, I started to feel different, and that got worse. As I got older, that got worse. And to the point where, you know, I can just remember looking in the mirror whenever I had to do that and just thinking, I just wasn't pleased. I was, you know, just at times, just, I can remember once, I mean, if you can remember one time when you went to the bathroom in the 6th grade and looked in the mirror, you have some self-esteem issues. Because I looked in the mirror and thought, you're a loser. I don't know why I thought that. I just believed it. And I kind of went on like that. And I didn't want, you know, I saw my parents using, my parents drank. They didn't do any drugs. I watched that. And we were extremely poor. And so in order to kind of take care of myself, I started delivering newspapers. And I just decided that, well, first of all, I wanted to buy my own clothes because I was sick of dressing up in these clown clothes my alcoholic parents were putting on me. So I went and got my own clothes. That kind of slowed the beatings down at school a little bit. And then I started buying my own food, which was nice because I didn't have to depend on them for that. My intentions were good. They really were. For a long time when I came here, I thought that my alcoholism, by and large part, was my parents' fault. And then it occurred to me after doing the steps finally that, you know, if anybody had a good example not to drink alcohol, it was me. You know, I really have no idea how I could hold my, and this is just me. If somebody else wants to blame their parents, go for it. It didn't work for me. I'm just telling you right now, and I don't have the greatest relationship with my parents, but blaming them for stuff, I watched their lives fall apart for 18 years. I watched it, and then I went and did it. And as soon as I did it, I loved it just as much as they did. So now we're all in the same boat together, you know. It's like, so you know, that was, you know, it's just kind of a new way to look at it now, and it's been helpful. So I got okay grades, and I actually started fitting in at school, and I got pretty popular and was doing all right, and then I started with substances. My first substance that I used was an alcohol. I didn't know I was going to be an Alcoholics Anonymous years later, so I smoked pot. I'm sorry. To be quite honest with you, at the first time nothing happened, so I felt guilty. I was just like, oh, geez, I don't want to do that. I'm going to become like my parents, and this is terrible, and oh, God. And then like 2 weeks later, I did it again. This time I got high, and I loved it. Once I got high, I was like, first of all, there's no way I was going to drink. I started setting up these rules immediately. Okay, it's okay to smoke pot as long as you don't buy it and you can't drink alcohol and, you don't want to hang out with drug dealers and you got to pay, I had all these rules. You don't steal from anybody. And so like then a month later, I'm like, well, you probably should buy it if you want to support yourself. You should support your own habit. And then after a while, I'm like, well, who cares about stealing from people to stealing from me? It just went on and on like this, And then after a while, when the town dries up and you're sick of huffing gas, and I smoked a tag once off a sleeping bag to see if that would get me high, I ended up drinking. And from the moment I drank on, I had problems with alcohol because I drank like a pig. And I have these really weird genes that when I should be like out like a light, I'm walking around talking. I'm telling people off is what I'm doing. I'm like weigh 100 pounds. I'm telling people, usually the biggest guy you could find. So I woke up in all sorts of configurations and weird messes. So one of the things that the first thing I did the first time I drank was I noticed right around 4 or 5 beers, I felt this really neat glow. And then like 12, 15 beers later, I'm waking up in the park or in the woods or something. Every time I went home, my parents would stop beating on each other for just long enough to go, hey, he's been drinking. And they'd say, where'd you get that alcohol? And I'd be like, I'm not telling you. And so they'd call the cops. I'd go to jail every time I came home drunk. They'd call the cops. I'd go to jail. If I didn't go to the hospital first, it was the hospital. Well, they almost took me to the hospital one time because I drank 2 big bottles of Mad Dog 2020. I stole 4, drank 2. There was a wino in the woods telling me, kid, you need to slow down. This is going to kill you. I learned, and I can remember thinking, man, if this guy's worried about me, maybe I'd take kind of back off a little bit. But I also remember that, and I'm not kidding either, he stopped drinking after. I had like 4 bottles. He only drank like 3/4 of one. He said, I can't drink that anymore. It was terrible. I blacked out the first time I drank, and I never even thought anything of it at all. I didn't come out of that first blackout and say, wow, I blacked out. I need to go to AA. I didn't even notice it. I mean, if you drank and didn't black out, then it wasn't enough. I didn't think, I grew up in an environment where everyone was blacking out. Everybody said things that, not things that they didn't mean. They just said things that they were going to say anyways. People I grew up with, they meant it. And if it was nasty and mean, they said it. That's just how I grew up. So, my experience with drinking was, I can remember, I drank 5 or 6 this one time, and I remember that little glow, and it kind of lasted for a couple seconds. Then, like I said, I'm waking up in a mess. And my drug of choice wasn't alcohol, just wasn't. So then I drank again, whenever. My pattern was whenever I couldn't find my drug of choice, I'd go drink because I'm a pig. I need something. And every time I drank, I can remember over and over again saying, okay, now this time, the problem with alcohol last time, the reason why I went to jail last time, and I went to jail a couple times, was because I just couldn't stop at 4 or 5 or 6. So I'd get to 4 or 5, and I'd be like, oh, this is great. It's working again. And then, boom, 13, and the same thing's happening. I went home one night extremely drunk. My mother's this short little Irish lady, and I went home and I didn't know who she was. I don't know how I got home, but I literally didn't know who this woman was yelling at me. She's like, "You've been drinking it," so this person was yelling at me. So I decided, well, I'm just going to have to knock this person out because I can't deal with this. So I don't know what happened, but the next thing I know, I'm waking up on the floor. My mother just destroyed me. And then my father comes home, and he mops the floor with me. And then the paramedics come home. Thank God they came to my house and got those two off me. It was just like, that's the way my drinking was. And even though alcohol wasn't my drug of choice, I can tell you right now, I just wasn't in a position where it could be. I really, my parents, one thing that they did well is they would just be all over me about my drinking. As far as they were concerned, it wasn't okay for a kid 12, 13, 14, 15 years old to be drinking. So I had to keep it to a dull roar. So eventually what I learned is if I was going to drink, go out in the woods and stay there. And that usually was all right. And that's what I did. That's really what I did. So, my using career Went into high school. I'm using every day. I'm still delivering newspapers, but everybody in the house, my alcoholic father's stealing money out of my paper bag. My mother's putting it back in. And my sister, who just had a problem with stealing, I guess, she was stealing it too. She's not even one of us, so she doesn't even have an excuse. She's just stealing from me. I'm like higher than a kite, so I don't know where this money's going. So eventually I had to quit delivering the newspaper. I owed them hundreds of dollars. And my parents and I have talked about it since. My mother's like, I kept putting money in and it just kept disappearing. I didn't know where it was. And, you know, everybody else was taking it. So whatever. It worked out. And as my using progressed, the first thing I want to make sure I don't forget is that the first time I did experience high from my first high happened to be with a substance other than alcohol, I loved it. As soon as I experienced that high, the guilt I felt weeks before was gone. Not only was the guilt gone, but within seconds, I said to myself, this is my solution, and anybody that tries to stand in my way of this solution is going to have a problem because I'm never letting go of this again. And I can remember thinking instantly, I felt sorry for everybody else who didn't have this solution. I couldn't believe that. I was that close to going through my life clean and sober. I mean, are you crazy? You know, I was just like, I couldn't believe it. I just couldn't believe it. It was like freedom. And as my disease progressed, like for the rest of us, it went from being like freedom to being like hell. As I got older, you know, 14, 15, my friends start dating. My drug and alcohol problem solved the dating problem because I could have cared less about dating. It was just like, who cares? Are you serious? A girlfriend? I mean, what? I'm going to have to share my alcohol with her. I actually had a girlfriend once, and she wanted some of my chemicals, and it was, no, see you later. I mean, I actually ended the relationship. I didn't know how I was going to entertain her anyway, so I just could have cared less. I just didn't, you know, selfish and self-centered was 100%, could have cared less. So, as high school progressed, people are talking about going to college. I'm going to go to this school. I'm going to get a license. And I used to think, I'm going to be a wino, so it's going to happen to me. I knew what was going to happen to me. And by that point, substances other than alcohol, you know, I think I got here right at the right time, and I'm very fortunate to be here because I don't think I wouldn't have lived long. I just don't think I would have. The way I drank and as much rage as I had, I wouldn't even be here. So, you know, when I first got here, my using towards the end is drinking more because I also started going, geez, you know, when you drink a lot and smoke a lot and do a lot of these other things, this is pretty awesome. So that started to work for me, and I started finding ways to keep it under wraps and make it work. And I came in here in my gut feeling probably a month before I figured out how to really work that. And I might not even be here if I'd ever figured that out. So I'd hear my friends talk about going to college and this girlfriend business and all this other stuff, and I used to go. I used to think to myself, like, I used to see, you know, you see the kids who study, you're like, wow, geez, somebody's actually studying. And then you see the other kids who cheat, and I used to say, I don't even have the ambition to cheat, man. I just don't even care. I don't even care, you know. I was the type of guy who, if you put SATs in front of me, I would have connected the dots to make stuffed animals or something and said, there's your SAT. I just didn't care. I didn't care about work. I wasn't going anywhere. So my father came into this program before me a couple of months before I did. And then, you know, once my mother and father got back together and all that business, it was almost as if they said, oh, geez, I think Dean has a problem with drugs and alcohol. He can't, if he's going to live here, he needs to do something about that. So anyways, every time I got caught using, which was quite often, I would have this big talk. Eventually, I got drafted into Alcoholics Anonymous. So, and I saw it worked for my father, and it was pretty bizarre to me. I didn't know what you folks were doing to him, but I was pretty shocked because I'd seen this guy lie to my mother since I was, you know, since I had a memory. And all of a sudden, I've seen more booze poured down the sink than not maybe you guys could imagine, but than I could ever imagine. There was, you know, and I can remember at 6, 7, and 8, I'd think, why does she keep believing him? He just did this last week. I'm sorry. And, oh, you know, they're crying and kissing, and he's pouring the booze. And then that night they're punching each other out, and he's drunk. You know, it's just like, but, you know, that as I got older, forgot all that, did all of it. No different. Same guy. And so, you know, as I came into my first meeting, I didn't really want what you people had, so I made sure that I didn't come in here straight. And I sat up in the back of the room and was like, oh, my God. And I was 16 years old, you know, and I didn't really feel like I fit in here. And there were plenty of people around that let me know, kids, you don't fit in here. And so I said, good, see ya, and it was fine with me. But some of the first things that I heard at meetings, I can remember some of my first experiences at meetings were like the first meeting I went to, this lady who was in her 60s, and she was drinking from a styrofoam coffee cup like the ones we have here. Some things never change. And I can remember watching her. There's like this much lipstick on the cup, and I can remember thinking, what the hell am I doing here? I mean, what do I have in common with this lady or any of these people? And she spoke within seconds after me thinking specifically about her, how different she was. She spoke, and it was exactly what I'd been thinking about that afternoon when I was out in the woods doing substances other than alcohol, thinking I was so unique and intellectual. And I was like, wow, I can't believe it. After that, I wasn't ready for your program yet, wasn't really interested, but I never forgot that. And so I left here for a couple of more months, convinced my parents that they saved me, they caught it just in time, I was experimenting, thank you very much, I'll do this again, and blah, blah, blah. And so a couple of months later, anyways, I had a near-death experience, as many of us can and do, doing too much of this and not enough of that. Once I survived it, I went to a meeting that night, and my original sobriety date is October 17th, 1984, so you notice I lost a couple of months there. We'll get to that in a minute. So October 17th, 1984, I call my father's sponsor, comes and picks me up, and I'm not going to say that he was old school AA, because that would be insulting to old school AA. He is just an older guy who'd been in AA for 150 years. But it didn't have any use for me. I didn't know what really. I've read Working with Others since then. He didn't do anything with me that night. That came out of the big book. He just made it up as he went. So you know, my indoctrination to AA was one of hostility. I had somebody yelling at me, calling me names. I'm this and that. I'm never going to get into it. You know, it was ridiculous. So I can remember thinking to myself, and he told me I was a liar, wasting everybody's time, whatever, and I guess everybody was busy or something, I don't know. But you know, I can remember that night I'm sitting out there smoking before I went into the meeting. This is the first meeting I ever went to because I wanted to go. I can remember thinking, I know they pick up a white chip. Do I want to pick up that white chip or not? And one thing I kept thinking is, man, I don't want to pick up that white chip because I'm a loser and that ain't going to work. It's just not. At 16 years old, I already felt like I was hopeless for no reason other than I just felt like I was hopeless. I don't know why I felt that. I just didn't feel like I could do this. And I'd been around AA enough, and I was appreciative enough to what you folks had done for my parents that I did. I already felt some sort of a loyalty to AA, so to speak. And I didn't want to waste your time. But I picked up a white chip anyways. Before I picked up that white chip, when I was up in my room that night, I heard you in your meetings talking about this higher power and how you'd get down on your knees and you ask God for help. And that was so weird that I just thought, you know, okay, well, we'll just ignore that because God and I had some issues. But anyways, I was thinking that before I went to that meeting that night, I remember hearing that, and I went and I did that. Laying up in my bed, and I said, God, if there is one, and I don't think there is, and I looked around, and I said, I know I've got this. I knew I was addicted to drugs at the time. I didn't know that I was going to have to include alcohol also. That's why my sobriety date's a little fuzzy. I did some experimenting. But I did. I asked God to remove the obsession to use. And I said, if you don't, I'm not going to be able to stay sober. It's that simple. So for some reason, somehow, it got very clear in my mind that I was not going to be able to quit on my own because I'd already tried 150,000 times. Why I had that moment of clarity, I don't know, but I was very lucky to have had it. So in at my father's bottom, left him on the couch of our house. My mother was gone. My brother and sister were gone, wherever they were. I was partying with my friends a few towns over, and I just want to mention this so I don't forget it because it just shows how selfish I had become. And I came in to get some clothes or whatever. My father, this is like February. in Maine. It gets really cold in February. And he's like sitting on the couch. He broke his hip because he got an OUI, so he took my sister's bicycle so he wouldn't get an OUI and went riding across town, got hit by a car, got an OUI on that. And now he's like trapped. Now he's like trapped on the couch, him and the dog. Nobody's there. The house is freezing. He smells like all kinds of things because nobody's moved him in days. I walked in, walked right by him, went and got the stuff I needed and left. And my thought was, I'm glad he can't move because he can't stop me. I could have cared less what happened. The house could have burnt down. I could have cared less. And so I just tried to, you know, that's where I was at. And it took a lot of training to get me there because I was pretty sensitive when I was just a little guy. By the time I was 16, I was a sociopath. I could have cared less what happened. And my number one concern with life is there were way too many people, and I didn't know how to get even with all of you before I went out with a bang. And you know, and that's what I was like when I first got sober. When I came into AA in 1984 in my area, it was you know, everybody has their own traditions, and what I'm going to start talking about some things that work for me and some things that don't work for me. And I've paid my dues for 24 years being miserable. So I hope what I say doesn't offend you, but I'm going to tell you right now, I'd rather offend somebody than have you sit there and think that I'm standing here happy for the last 26 years because I did what I wanted, because that's not my experience. The first 24 years of my sobriety, the first 17 years of my sobriety, I did what I like to call hard time. I just did nothing but stayed sober. That was it. You know, I'd sponsor you maybe if it fit in. I don't know. We're not going to do the steps. I'll give you some advice, but don't ask me to do the steps. We're not doing those. And you know, my first sponsor, I love this guy like a parent. He saved my life. I'm convinced of it. That my first sponsor is a younger guy. Came in and undid a lot of the damage that was done from this first guy I was going to meetings with, and he did a lot of the things right. Now that I read the book, by right I mean effectively. He met me where I was at when I was hesitant to talk about myself. He talked about himself. Got me to open up. I can remember thinking my first ride to the meeting with my first sponsor, I can remember thinking, why are you telling me all this stuff about you? Are you stupid? I can also remember thinking, because I ain't going to tell you anything about me. And then, like, within a half an hour, I started talking to him about myself. And I was a pretty hardened kid, even at 16. But the reason why I did that is because there was one alcoholic reaching out to another, and I was open to getting sober. But I didn't know that at the time. And thank God he read that big book. And my introduction to AA, I think I started out on good grounds. It was the behaviors that I participated in afterwards, and some of the other stuff that I got into that was isn't really too bad. So I got sober, and you know, meeting makers make it one day at a time. Don't quit before the miracle. Blah blah blah. No relationships in the first year. I was at a step meeting. You could smoke back then. Imagine that in a room. And I'm sitting in the basement smoking. We're doing the steps, and by doing the steps, I don't mean we're working with anybody doing the steps. We're all sitting down, reading the step book, right, and talking about what we think about the steps. I didn't know anything about the steps, you know. So anyways, I'm sitting there, and the room is so smoky, I can't even see across the room. And there's this woman who always used to go to the meeting, and she's like crying. She cried every day, I mean, that we went to these meetings together. And I can remember after 6 months looking at her, and she's always crying like she always has been, and I can barely see her, and I'm looking at the step book and I'm thinking, what am I doing here? I don't even know what I'm doing. Why am I even here? And then I thought, well, I don't know. I guess it's all right. And that was like one moment of clarity, but it didn't go anywhere. I didn't know what I was doing. I didn't know why she was crying. I didn't know what anybody was doing. I just knew that this AA thing was better than what I had been doing when I was drinking. And I also thought to myself, I'm getting bored being sober, so I'm going to get a girlfriend. That was my next idea. And let me tell you something, that started off a whole bunch of years of bad ideas after that. It went from relationships I shouldn't have been in, to jobs I had no business chasing after, to you name it, you know, think problems other than alcohol, as my sponsors like to say, problems other than alcohol. And I also didn't know that my own attitude could become addictive and could become a problem. What I learned growing up in my house was men could be depressed and men could be angry. That's it. Anxiety, women did that. You can't be anxious. Nobody can be anxious. And I'm sorry if it sounds sexist. I grew up in a very sexist environment where people were punching each other out and they were very rude to each other. We weren't doing the politically correct thing. We were very angry and nasty towards each other. So that's what I learned. And You know, so then I'm sobering up, and first of all, society's changing. People would like it if you, you know, would stop punching each other in the face and stop being mean to each other. And, you know, so I'm like, oh, my God, you know, and I don't want to go to jail. You know, I got to stop this behavior. And plus, in AA, everybody's talking about loving each other and just you got to love yourself, but you can love anybody else. I've proved I've loved all kinds of people. I hated myself. I loved all kinds of people anyways. It was very abusive, but I tried anyways. And it was not a it was not a solution for me, but you know what? It kept me distracted long enough to keep me alive. Because if, and I have no idea, my sponsor and I have gone back and forth with this, and my sponsors will sometimes say, well, I just don't think this was here when I first started, and I just think he's being nice because this message, no, he would say, I think this message was here, I just wasn't hearing it. This message that I'm talking about tonight was not here. I'd never heard it. And it wasn't because I didn't go to meetings. I went to, if 90 and 90 worked, I went to like 180 and 90. I did that for the first 5 years if I could. I went to a meeting a day. I was like in suspended animation. I couldn't work. All of a sudden, I was like disabled. I worked just enough. I worked just enough to pay my bills, and that was it. I can remember sitting at a coffee shop one time with this old guy named Bo, who was in his 70s, and he was in AA. And I'm like 20, 21, and I'm just going to AA meetings, and I have this job in a group home where I'm working like 2 or 3 days. I'm working with mentally ill people, keeping them calm, and it's the only thing that's keeping me together, to be quite honest. It's the only way, the only reason why I didn't drink, I think, for all those years not helping people is because of my job. I had a job helping people. I walked into a group home with people extremely violent. I just released from the state hospital at the time. That's what we were doing in that area, and I was great at it. I mean, go figure. I grew up in an alcoholic household and been dodging shoes and pieces of furniture, and geez, I can talk to these people that are violent and calm them down. I don't know where I got that talent from, but, you know, but that really saved me. But the, you know, the other stuff I was doing, I was coming here looking to fill that hole with what you thought of me, or you know, if I went out with a girl and if I loved her, if one of my friends said, oh man, I don't know, she's a little weird looking, I would get rid of her. Period. It'd just be the end of that. I had no ability to say, I don't care what you think. I love her anyways. It's just like, I look back on that. You know, it's very painful to be that insecure. And to be, you know, most people say, well, you should be, you're a pig, you know. I'm sorry, you know, I don't want to be like that. I didn't think that was a cool thing to do. That wasn't my goal. And so you know, I hung out here, I drank your coffee, I listened to your suggestions. I made up some of my own. Everybody seemed to be kind of doing that, so I added some of my own. You know, you could read the big book if you wanted to, but why do that? There's all these other cool books around, and that's, you know, and then the whole loving yourself thing. I used to listen to that and go, that's a crock, because I hate myself, and that's never going to change. And so I just kind of started cornering the market on like gloomy AA. You know, I would go to a meeting, man, if people were happy, I'd change that in a hurry. I'd do whatever I could. I'd do whatever I could to say, you phony so-and-sos. And I mean, it would just, I would confront people. It was nasty. It was terrible. And as time went on, another thing that happened to me that I'm lucky didn't kill me is as I got more and more important. You know, I come from a family background and people didn't go to school and people didn't have much prestige and stuff. Well, I went to school and I found out and I had all these concerns that I was dumb and whatever because I stayed back in third grade. You know, so here I go. I got one degree, I got another degree. And see, I'm not stupid. And then all of a sudden, you know, I got the jobs and all of a sudden, couldn't go to AA anymore, guys. I'm sorry. But, you know, at one point I had a job in law enforcement and I had the odd experience of wrestling somebody to the ground that I had hung out with the night before at an AA meeting. I was like, we're done with that. No more AA. Done. And that's going to ruin my career. You know, who cares about my soul or my life or you know, my spirituality, happiness? Didn't need any of that. So, and my wife at the time, I can't remember, would be out in public and if she said something, it looked like she was having fun or whatever. I'd think, oh, you need to knock that off. You know, see, you're publicly looking like you're happy and having a good time. You need to knock that off. It was like I was running for president or something. I don't know what was going on, but I was talking to my sponsor about this. The whole police thing. I did that for a bit, and what happened with that is I've never said this from the podium. I said it in my fourth and fifth step, like it was a big secret. But what happened with the whole police thing is I got to the academy. And they have, like, some rules and stuff they want you to follow. And I didn't think it was a good idea. So I ended up turning the whole administration of the academy and the cadets against each other. And so I, like, led a little alcoholic mutiny. They didn't know I was a dry alcoholic. They didn't know they had one of us in there who wasn't working a program. And And you know, I mean, it caused a lot of hate and discontent over there. I never said I was sorry to anybody, and if you didn't like it, too bad. So I got fired is what happened. After I graduated from the academy, because they couldn't find a way to fire me, I went back to the station, and my chief asked for my gun and my badge. I gave it to him, came out, done, fired. That career was destroyed. Every time I tried to get a job after that, nobody wanted me. And let me tell you why, because I was unstable. It was just like, nobody, you don't want him working here. And so that career was flushed down the toilet. As my time in sobriety progressed, I started my own business, which was good for me because I couldn't get along with anybody. So I started buying and selling stuff. I traveled all over the country. I'd go to a lawn sale, buy some stuff, and whatever, say something nasty to somebody, leave, go sell it on the internet. I was getting in arguments with people on the internet. I mean, it was terrible. I had four people working for me. I ended up with two stores. I ended up running two stores. I got these people working for me. I'd come in, people would be having fun until I came to work, and then it was like silence. You think Scrooge was bad. This was terrible. And these people, they couldn't talk to me. I couldn't be reasoned with. I was just miserable. And at the 17-year mark, I ended up, I'm at home in my long johns at 2 in the afternoon, because that's what you do when you're a depressed alcoholic with no solution. And I'm sitting there playing solitaire, because that's another thing I like to do. It was just me and the game. Not a lot of interaction. And my business partner calls me up and he goes, "Hey, Dean, geez, remember that guy? My brother-in-law, we were playing poker with his. My sister is all mad at him and she wants a divorce. He needs to do something about his drinking. Don't you go to AA?" I mean, this is my best friend now, mind you. He didn't even know if I went to AA or not. Didn't you go to AA once or something? You know, could you talk to him? And I can remember thinking, no, I can't talk to him. And my best thinking up at that point, I started thinking to myself, you know what? I know I can't drink because people in my family, when they drank, were extremely crazy. I definitely got to stay away from that. But I think the whole pot thing was just a phase, so maybe I could smoke a little pot. I mean, geez, you know, who doesn't smoke pot in high school? It's a big deal. I was thinking, that was one thing I was thinking. The other thing I was thinking is maybe I ought to shoot myself in the head. So those are my two thoughts. Those are my best thinking after 17 years of doing it my way, doing the discussion meeting thing, you know, just hanging there, kid. If you need some help, maybe that guy will help you, but I'm not going to. That thinking got me into this place where I was just thinking about either using or shoot myself. So I can remember thinking, if I say no, this voice, and I don't hear voices, and this was an outside voice. This is probably the worker in me trying to explain it to you what kind of voice this was. It wasn't inside my head. But this voice said to me, "Dean, if you don't help this guy, you're done. This obsession that I removed from you 17 years ago is going to come back. Good luck with that." And I wasn't scared of anything at that time. As a matter of fact, one of the reasons why I became a police officer was I was hoping somebody would shoot me in the face. Nobody ever did. So suicide wasn't scaring me, but drinking did scare me. And I really felt, for whatever reason, that if I didn't help this guy, the obsession to use is going to be back and I wouldn't be able to stop it. So I thought, oh, man. Then right before I started trying to deal with that, this next thought came into my mind that I think was, you know, God has a sense of humor. My God does. The next thought was, "Dean, these alcoholics don't listen anyway. So you'll only be on the phone with him for a couple of minutes. You know how they are." And I said, "Okay, that's a good deal." I said, "Yeah, I'll do it. I have him call me." And he called, and I'm still playing my game. And he said, "Hey, my name's so-and-so." And this is, he's telling me what's going on. And so I was listening to him, and then like 5 minutes later, I actually stopped playing my game. I sat up, was listening to him some more, and it was almost like 17 years had never happened. I remembered when I first came here, the people that were trying to help me in AA, I remembered what they had done for me, and I can remember many of them saying, "You don't ever have to pay me back, Dean, just do this for somebody else in the future." So I started talking to this guy, and that was around noontime. This guy I wasn't going to talk to. And at 4 in the morning, I lived across from the school at that time. At 4 in the morning, we were over there coming up with a plan for his recovery. And I was going to, you know, actually sponsor this guy. And it's funny because I hated the steps, and everybody who worked the steps hated them too. And he goes, "Okay, well, yeah, you'll be my sponsor." I said, "Sure." And he goes, "Well, so what should we do?" And I remember going, "Well, I can tell you what you're not going to do." And that's what I just got done doing for 17 years. So I said, "Well, you know, I think we should do the steps." He goes, "Oh, what are those?" And I said, and I told him what they were, it's best I knew. And I didn't know they were in the big book. I thought I knew everything about AA, but I didn't even know the steps were in the big book. And I'm not a dumb guy, you know. I didn't even know the steps were in the big book. But I said, "We're gonna do the steps." And I went and I grabbed, he said, "Well, Well, how are we going to do that? And I said, well, actually, I'm going to go inside as soon as you leave, and I'm going to start reading them because I've never done them before, so I need to do them before you. And you know, that's really how it started. And I went and found my first sponsor, who was a pharmacist, and I love this. Like I said, I love this guy like he's my father, but he could never stay out. He was a pharmacist, kind of testing his stuff on the side, you know, so to speak, and he could never get out of that. So I went and found him, and even though he was high, I didn't care. Hey, take me through the steps, will you? He just had to take me through the steps again. I pretended he wasn't high. Just take me through the steps. You know, I just didn't even care. You know, here I got 17 years of sobriety. He didn't even have 17 minutes. And I was still, again, selfish. I didn't care that the guy who saved my life was dying. I could have cared less. All I knew is that's the one guy I had a connection with. I was very clicky in his program, and that's the guy who was going to take me back through the steps. I mean, I should have, if nothing else, it would have been nice if I could have been a power of example to him. But he didn't. There was no freedom in my eyes that day. I was just still looking. I was convinced I didn't have any answers, so I'm sure that struck him as different. But in his pill-induced haze, I don't know what he saw. But you know, I just saw a guy who could, he was playing a role. He needed to get me through the steps. So anyways, I got through the steps. I took this other guy through. And when I first started reading the step book, which isn't my book of choice now, I just prefer just to read the big book. And nothing against the step book; it's great. But I read the big book. That's where my information is, and that's what I do. So, you know, I picked that step book up though, and that's where I had my first spiritual awakening. The first spiritual awakening I had was in 1984 when I first came to this program. The obsession to use was lifted from me. The second spiritual awakening I had was that day when I started working with that guy. I picked up that skinny little step book. This is after 4 years of college. At this point, I had a bachelor's degree now. And, you know, the big, you know, the step book, the big book, are you kidding me? I mean, this is like, these books are dumb, right? So anyways, I picked up that skinny, dumb little book, and I opened it up, and a guy, I hadn't cried in years. I mean, crying's just not part of what I thought was helpful, so I just didn't do it. You know, I didn't have any feelings. And so I pick up this big book, the step book, I opened it up, and I started crying, and I couldn't stop it. I cried for days. My wife at the time got really angry because she was trying to help me, and it was, you know how we are, right? You know, I God's the only person, the only thing that can help me. And she just saw me change, didn't know why, and I just started working with people. And I didn't know what I was doing, but you know what? I was doing it. Didn't matter. I just was making it up. I had one guy say, first of all, I was so cranky that when I started going to meetings and I wasn't, like, threatening to shoot people anymore, people were like, wow, it's a miracle. What happened to him? And everybody started wanting me to sponsor him. Will you sponsor me? Sure. You know, I'm on step two. I'll sponsor you. Let's do it. You know, I didn't know what I was doing. I'm reading this step book, the reason why I couldn't stop crying is I was just shocked at how the answers were right behind me. They were 3 feet behind me. I just never looked at it. It wasn't interested. You know, I don't really know what to. You know, when it says in How It Works, we beg of you, beg me all you want. Until I've had enough pain, you're not going to reach me. Don't even try to talk to me. And those of you in here who are really smart, like I thought I was, you're even harder to reach. I was even harder to reach because of my ability to BS. It was just that simple. You couldn't talk. There's no talking to me. Do yourself a favor. Find somebody else to talk to. Talk to me later. And so after 17 years, when I first sobered up in the 80s, everybody in AA who had like 2 weeks of sobriety became a substance abuse counselor. And I used to say, why the hell would you want to do that? And I hated that. I was just like, I thought that was terrible. So after 17 years of sobriety, my wife at the time, as you notice, my wife at the time, there's been a little bit of a change there. She told me, you know, Dean, my first wife, I'd been with her for many years. She didn't even know me when I went to AA. That's how she started out the sentence. I didn't know you when you went to AA, but when you work with those alcoholics, something happens to you. I don't know what it is, but you're just a lot nicer to be around. I would suggest there was a rehab in my area. And she said, I'd suggest you go volunteer over there. And I did, and it turned into a full-time job, and I just kept going to school, and that's what I do today, and I work in the business, and I've thought long and hard about if I want to mention that or not, and decided in the end to mention it, because there's a couple of things that I just want to say for me that are true as a substance abuse counselor. One of the things that I just absolutely don't believe in, and if you do, fine. We don't need to discuss it. I'm not going to discuss it with you. I'm just going to tell you right now, the fact that I do that at work does not mean it's okay for me when I go home not to sponsor people, because I do it at work. It's not the same thing. When I work with people, I am getting paid, not very well, but pretty well, you know, and I get treated very well, and I love my job, but it's not. And I cannot work with people the same way I can out of the big book. Very different. You know, as a substance abuse counselor, the one thing that I do that I think makes me effective is I'm hooked up with you folks. And these doctors and psychiatrists, they don't know what I'm doing, but I don't know, call Dean. He sends them off to these people in AA. They're doing something. I don't know. It's great. Work seems to be great. You know, I call these people with a solution. I call people who sponsor people who sponsor people, who work with the steps with people out of the big book. And, you know, does it work all the time? Of course not. You know, you guys aren't so naive that you're going to believe that, and I'm not going to tell you that. It doesn't work. There are people that, you know, I don't know. When I start working with you, I don't know how much pain you've been through. You may have been through enough pain so we can get through step three. You may have been through enough pain so we can make it through five. Maybe you've been through enough pain so we can make it through all 12. I know guys. I've taken guys through all 12. I don't know, they're waiting for the magic to happen or something, and then they just don't go help nobody. So, guess you didn't have enough pain. You know, step 12, it's not, for me, it's not so much, you know, how effective, you know, how much work did I put into the steps. It was how much action did I throw into there, and how much am I willing to do to take action afterwards. And I want to spend the last few minutes I have here explaining a couple of things from my perspective that have meant just a major difference to me, and that is, you know, I used to hear in AA that, you know, a head full of AA and a belly full of beer, but it doesn't mix. But great, that's great. Listen, I don't have a drinking problem. I have a drinking solution. So please don't, if you can't offer me a sober solution, you know, a spiritual solution, don't ruin my drinking. What am I going to do? You ruin my drinking and you don't encourage me to seek answers elsewhere, then what? Now my drinking's ruined, so guess what? I develop all kinds of nasty other weird little habits I didn't want to have in the first place. I was much happier when I was just drinking, thank you very much. I wasn't a pervert then, and I wasn't overeating too much. I wasn't working five jobs. You know, so it's like, it's like, just leave me alone. If you can't offer me a spiritual solution, leave me alone. You know, I'm not a problem drinker, and I'm not a heavy drinker. I'm an alcoholic. I'm the type of guy who, if I can't find a solution, I just assume not be here, and for some reason I don't have the courage to kill myself, so I'm hoping you will do it. Thank you. And that's not how I want to be living my life. As far as I'm concerned, AA isn't here to ruin your drinking. AA is here to reconnect you with a higher power. AA is here to solve the lack of power dilemma. I don't know about you guys, but for me it was a massive dilemma. When I felt empty, you paid. It was as simple as, that's what I learned. Brutality. It's as simple as that. You know. And it was a terrible way to live, but I got a high off from that. That was another way I could stay away from emotional sobriety, just sheer rage. If you don't like it, what are you going to do about it? I mean, it's crazy. It's ridiculous. I don't have to live that way anymore. Today, you know, I have my wife's in recovery. I have two little boys, son Jack, 2.5 years old, another son Liam, who's starting to act a lot like me. I hope he doesn't. Anyways, I'll just keep praying for him. He's a year old. And you know, I'm 42 years old. I didn't start having kids until I was 40, so that just goes to show you I didn't take that decision lightly. I just didn't want part of that. If I was going to be the kind of guy I saw growing up, you know, there's plenty of kids who have parents like that. I'm not. If I stick close to this program and to the solution, I'm not worried about them growing up in that mess. If I don't, that's exactly what's going to happen. You know, So, you know, I try to remember that. And I also try to remember that. So if AA isn't here to ruin my drinking, AA is actually here to ruin my selfishness. You know, when I read the book, Selfish Self-Centeredness, That We Think Is the Root of Our Troubles, you know, Bill Wilson was so nice. That we think is the root of... Let me explain something to you. I know exactly that that's the root of my troubles. Thank you anyways, but just say it. You know, that's the root of my troubles. Selfish self-centeredness. And I guess, you know, the way I treat that... If selfish self-centeredness is the root of my troubles, the way I treat that is through action by helping others. And let me explain to you what that feels like. To a selfish self-centered alcoholic like me, that feels a lot like, oh, God, the Red Sox are playing today. We haven't won a game in like 3 weeks. Maybe today will be the day we win the game. I don't want to go help this guy with his steps. Who cares? He's probably not going to stay sober anyways. I'll just deal with him later. I'll call him tomorrow. You know, people die not because of anything I don't or do specifically, but because of our inaction. Because of my inaction. For many years, when I could have been helping people, didn't bother. It wasn't interested. And it wasn't because, I don't think that all of these discussion meetings that I went to, all the stuff that I was involved in, I don't think anybody did anything on purpose. I don't think people were trying to mess up, you know, the program. One of the reasons why I have decided to talk about what I do for work is what I do for work doesn't belong in here, in my opinion. What I do for the psycho mumbo jumbo, I have a master's degree in psychology, does not belong in AA, my opinion. And You know, I can tell you right now, I know a whole bunch of things to help you with your fear of spiders. I know nothing to help you with your alcoholism. Alcoholism is a spiritual problem. This is, I have some ideas to provide you some. I can help you with some direction on how to help other people to deal with your selfishness, to help with the spiritual disease of alcoholism. That's what I believe it to be. There's no psychological. If there was a psychological solution to it, I just missed it. I just talked to tons and tons of doctors who told me I passed. Good job. Nobody ever called me in their office and said, "Dean, I'm glad you're here. There's this groundbreaking work in alcoholism. I want to talk to you about it. It's amazing. We're sobering people up left and right, and they just stay sober. So it doesn't work that way. And the more I talk to people about my self-esteem, and the more they talk to me about how special I am, and the more I talk back to them about, geez, I couldn't agree more, the sicker I get. It's just that simple. And I'm not here to say that there's no room for counseling or therapy. I don't do that for work because I think it, you know, I wouldn't be doing it if I thought there was no use to it. I just think that there's a time and a place for it. And I'm not telling anybody in AA, don't seek outside help. I deal with that all the time at work. I have psychiatrists saying, well, I don't know. I know you people in AA sometimes don't like medications. I'm like, hang on a second. We don't, and I talk about what's in the big book. And I can straighten some of that out in my own little corner. You know, and that's important that I do that. Because I represent both of those worlds. And it's a weird place to be, but, you know, I do love my job. And if it wasn't for this program, I wouldn't be able to do any of that. And, again, before I forget, I want to thank one of the things I want to make sure that I just do is just thank this group for its support. This message that I talk about that I knew nothing about, year 24, had no clue about. 2 years later, you know, I can sponsor people out of the big book and we go right through it, just like I did with the last guy. And if it doesn't work, it's not about me. It just didn't work. You know, I know I'll do it until we're done. That's what I need to do. So. I really want to thank Jeff, who's been up and spoke up in our area, and the other people in this area who've been up there. It's great. My area needs it. We really appreciate it. And thanks for having me. Thank you.